Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Sunlight Junior, starring Matt Dillon and Naomi Watts, is available on demand now before it hits theaters. Premiering October 11th is the controversial Escape from Tomorrow, about a family's theme park vacation that turns into a surreal nightmare. Shot on location in Orlando, it's available on demand before it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This episode is also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SVU1013.
New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. In this installment, we look at whether or not filmmaker Leos Carax is able to breathe new life into that well-worn cliché of a painter with failing eyesight falling in love with a fire-breathing acrobat while they're both living on a famous French landmark in The Lovers on the Bridge.
Later in the episode, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles to rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme. In honor of The Lovers on the Bridge, we were going to discuss some other dark love stories. But Matt, your insistence that both The Exorcist and Full Metal Jacket were, in their own ways, romances, made it clear that your ideas about the category were a little more complicated than could fit into an hour-long episode. So instead, we're doing films set in Paris.
They're not? I still don't understand. How are they not? You explain it to me. I'm putting the burden of proof on you, Allison.
Yes, tune in to a special 10-hour episode of Film Spotting.
The Great Romances of Film by Matt Singer, including The Exorcist, Full Metal Jacket, Sallow, and more. Yes, the romances. All the love. All the passion.
Yes, sponsored by ... but first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what are our picks this week?
Well, it's good that it was my turn to pick out some movies, because I got to talk about some romances, even though you tried to stop me. I wouldn't let you. I soldiered on, and I've got three really fabulous romances to recommend on VOD on this episode, starting with Man of Tai Chi, the fine romance and directorial debut of Keanu Reeves, who actually does a very respectable job directing this movie. Sometimes we talk about actors becoming good directors. They work with good directors. They learn. They pay attention. And then they become good directors in themselves. You know, George Clooney hanging out with Steven Soderbergh, and he becomes a really good director in his own right. Ben Affleck was paying attention to Michael Bay and Kevin Smith. Whatever. You get the idea. In Keanu's case, there's a guy who made some of the most awesome kung fu movies of all time, and he was clearly paying attention while he was doing it, because he's made a very good one here. He co-stars in the film as the super serious, mega evil villain. So basically, Allison, in one decade, Neo has transformed into Agent Smith, which is kind of interesting in and of itself, that he cast himself in like the evil Agent Smith role. The conflicted hero in this case is played by Tiger Chan, who's a martial artist and stuntman, who worked with Keanu Reeves actually on the Matrix films. They go back that far, and he cast him as the hero here. The results aren't quite as effective as when Quentin Tarantino cast a stunt woman in Death Proof. I don't think Tiger Chan is quite as good an actor. But it's still a very successful and very, again, respectable film here. In the story, Tiger plays this young Tai Chi master who enjoys competing in martial arts tournament, which is already kind of against the psychology or the philosophy of Tai Chi, because Tai Chi is very, like, peaceful and nonviolent, what have you. So he's already kind of against the grain of Tai Chi. He works as a day job as a courier. He's very poor. So naturally, when the Tai Chi temple that he trains and prays at is in danger of being knocked down by evil developers, he's very easily seduced by Keanu Reeves' character, who is like this evil billionaire named Donica, into joining what else? An underground fight club where rich people wager on deadly martial arts battles.
How would you like to test how good you are, Tiger? Or could become? No referees. No rules. pure fighting. I can't fight Tai Chi for money. It's dishonorable. We want to see a pure-hearted man of Tai Chi become a killer.
He says he's just undergone fighting. But it's something else.
Killer be killed, Tiger. That's what I want.
And there's some themes about the battle between modernity and tradition, between capitalism and spiritualism, between the beauty of martial arts, between the brutality of martial arts. And I think there's enough there that kind of elevates the movie into a higher level of martial arts film. And the choreography is by Yuen Wu Ping, who also did the Matrix movies with Keanu. So that kind of elevates it a little as well. And I actually think Keanu Reeves uses Keanu Reeves very well in this film. You know, he plays everything deadly straight, but there is an element of camp to everything he does. And there's a few lines he repeats over and over again, including this one that I'm personally trying to make into an internet meme, and it's not working because no one has seen this movie, but maybe if everyone on the podcast audience watches, maybe it'll happen. And the line is, "You owe me a life." And he says that to Tiger Chan about 100,000 times in this movie, over and over. "You owe me a life." So I want him. I'm really trying to make that happen. And I enjoyed Man of Tai Chi. It's available now on VOD. And in closing, Allison, San Dimas High School football rules.
And who are the lovers in this romance?
Keanu Reeves and Tiger Chan. It's a love hate relationship.
Right. Oh, sorry.
They love.
So, I can't believe I asked.
They both love Tai Chi, and kind of fighting. And they dislike when they're not fighting each other.
Got it.
They're stark. It's a Romeo and Juliet. Essentially, it's like West Side Story with more spin kicks. Actually, less spin kicks, because that was what. But there was some spin kicking in West Side Story. Less finger snapping than West Side Story. How's that?
How much singing?
Not as much as I would like, but it's there, instead of singing, there's fighting.
Right.
If they were singing and fighting,
would be amazing.
It would be even better. Yeah. But anyway, that's Man of Tai Chi. Recommended for the martial arts fans out there, and it's available now on VOD. Very quickly, we've got two other recommendations, both definitely romances. The first, which will be available on VOD starting on October 15th, is Drug War, directed by John Ito. This is more Asian action for the Asian action fans out there. It's a very classically John Ito-style film, if you've seen any of his stuff. It's got undercover cops, alliances between drug dealers and cops, the heroes and the villains. It's very hard to tell the difference between them sometimes. There's lots of gray areas. You don't know who can be trusted and what's happening at all times. It's basically about a cop who nabs this drug dealer. And because the drug dealer has kind of like a death sentence hanging over his head, he agrees to help the cop take down this big drug smuggling ring. But you're never really sure whether the drug dealer can be trusted. That's sort of the big if hanging over the plot. And I'm actually not the biggest Johnny Doe fan in the world, but I actually I like this one a lot. This one, I think, is, you know, like, to me, he's got hits and misses. This one to me was a big hit. You know, really good action, really great acting, very intense acting, and good script. It's definitely one of his better movies, I think. So that's Drug War, and it's available on VOD starting on October 15th. And finally, I mentioned it at the top of the show. It's available on October 11th. It's Escape from Tomorrow, directed by Randy Moore. I'm not the biggest fan of this movie, but certainly this is a really fascinating story if you haven't heard about it. Essentially, this guy, Randy Moore, made an entire movie at Disney World, Disneyland, covertly, guerrilla style, with no permission from Disney. He just snuck into the park with his actors, filmed them all with little, you know, consumer cameras, and they got away with it somehow. They managed to make the entire movie, you know, in the shadow of the Cinderella's castle and the Epcot dome and all this. And it definitely adds an interesting hook to this surreal movie about this family. The father has just lost his job at the start of the movie. He's kind of having a mental breakdown, and the reality around him seems to break down into this disturbing kind of Lynchian nightmare of the dark side of Disney. Again, I don't know if it really works as well in execution as it does in theory. It feels very much like me to as a first film. because it's kind of messy, and you can tell the director wants to say something, but I'm not sure he ever figured out what that something is. But again, it's the chutzpah alone here on display makes it worth watching and wrestling with. And even if there are better movies, I think, out there, there's a few more interesting ones recently. This is something, you know, it's unbelievable just that it's being released at all, for that matter. So it is very cool that you'll be able to see it. That's Escape from Tomorrow, and it'll be available on VOD starting on October 11th.
We're very happy to have Shutterstock.com back as a sponsor of this episode of Film Spotting SVU. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. You can choose from over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animation, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips, and many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock reviews each video individually for content and quality before adding it to its library, and Shutterstock adds 12,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new.
Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy with sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. And as you find the video assets you're looking for, you can save them to a clip box, and you can access your selections anytime and share them with other team members. Shutterstock has flexible pricing, and you can choose from individual clips or video packs, and you can download clips in HD so you can save them with standard definition or other web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code SVU1013, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code SVU1013. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Tu m'as dit, j'ai rendez-vous dans un sous-sol avec des fous qui vivent la guitare à la main du soir au matin. Alors je t'ai accompagné. On a chanté, on a dansé, et l'on n'a même pas pensé à s'embrasser. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées.
All right, we decided on Paris movies as the theme of this episode because The Lovers on the Bridge is set, although not entirely shot, as I later learned and we can discuss, in Paris. This is an interesting category because it's very large, actually.
It is very large.
There's almost too many choices, frankly. We probably should have gone with something else, but it was too late to change.
Well, we had a lot of requests for French films, which was an even broader category. So
that's
Paris
true.
Seemed like an easier way to narrow that down.
I guess.
Then again, Paris is such an
almost
important city
French
to the history
movies
of cinema.
Of note.
Also,
yeah.
That it's a setting for that's important for a lot of films, including. We just want to throw a few out there before
yes,
we get to
do.
Our picks.
Are they romances?
Everything's a romance.
Yes.
In Paris,
that's
is
true.
Romantic.
That's true.
But you know, some of the kind of great classics of film like Breathless and The 400 Blows set in Paris, streaming on Hulu Plus right now, or it also lends itself well as a city to these big outsized romances, but you know, that are also
favorite.
That are also kind of stylishly, you know, memorable. Something like Amelie, mm-hmm. which is currently streaming on Amazon.
I thought you were going to say like Sleepless Night, the beautiful romance about a cop punching
and a
people
restaurant.
In the faces.
Yes. or Moulin Rouge,
oh,
which you
yes.
can rent on Vudu or YouTube.
Or not.
Or not. Or I would probably skip it.
Yeah.
Yeah. and just to counter those, I should also throw out La Haine. Set, you know, in the
deeply
suburbs.
Deeply romantic.
Yes, set in the suburbs of Paris as well as in the city of Paris.
Yeah.
About a side of Paris that you don't see in Amelie.
Truly.
And that is currently streaming on Hulu Plus as well.
Mm.
But, you know, it's a big city and also one that's very important to cinema. So it's tough to generalize about it in any way. I would actually, it doesn't really apply to what we're talking about in terms of the main film this time, but I think something about people visiting Paris could be its own interesting category.
Yes, there's
because
a lot
there
of
are a lot of films about coming to Paris to attempt to live in Paris, or visiting.
Visiting, or, and things going horribly wrong.
There's
a lot of like anxiety that Americans on screen face when they come to Paris. Their wives get mysteriously kidnapped, or they forget who they are, and they you know, I'm not your wife, you must be crazy. And there's a bunch of movies like that.
Yeah, and also ones in which there's this big divide between expectations, and I feel like, and then reality, you know, because it's Paris.
Paris.
And then if it doesn't live up to being Paris, then they're problems.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because normally when we pick a subject, I do a ton of research and, you know, like, what are the best movies? And then, okay, these are too obvious. What are the ones that are a little off the beaten path so that maybe some listeners haven't heard them before and we're recommending, you know, a little more usefully things that maybe people haven't seen? And, you know, maybe I was just lazy this week. But what I did instead was, because I'm definitely not an expert on Paris, either on or off screen, and I'm not going to pretend to be, is I just went with literally the first two movies that came to mind. And luckily, they both happened to be streaming and or rentable. So that's how I did it. I just said, when I hear Paris movies, what do I think of? Two movies kind of came to mind first. Partly, well, you'll see why one of them definitely did. It's possible that another week, one of these two movies might not have. And frankly, the other movie, Frankenheimerly, the other movie, if I can spoil it a little bit, is not one I would have expected, but for some reason it popped in, and lo and behold, it was available. How did you pick your movies?
Well, there were a bunch that I had in mind that were not available for streaming.
Oh,
so,
do you want to mention those?
Like Flight of the Red Balloon, the Bo Shoshan film, which I love.
Surprising, that's not streaming.
It's not streaming. Okay. And I don't remember now, but I there were like several Rififi. Not streaming.
Rififi is a good one.
You know, there were a lot that came to mind that weren't out there. And then, you know, there are a lot that, as I mentioned, are on Hulu Plus because of the Criterion
movies. Yep.
Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to steer away from some of the giant, obvious, you know,
right,
films like
sure.
Breathless. So
yeah, the people don't need us to say Breathless is a really good movie. They probably
know. You
know
that. Breathless at this point. Yeah.
That's right.
So,
and if you don't, you could just you go see it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I kind of picked, I wanted to pick one that was kind of like a kind of more classic version, and then one that's, let's say, a new classic.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't you start? What's the what are we going to hear, the classic or the new classic?
Let's go with the classic.
All right.
It's my streaming pick.
Okay.
It's Cleo from 5 to 7, which is currently streaming on Hulu Plus. Mm-hmm. And this is the 1962 film from Agnes Varda, which is kind of a real-time film in that it is about a character named Cleo, played by Corinne Marchand, who's a pop star who is waiting to hear back from her doctor as to whether or not she has cancer. And it follows her from 5 to like 6:30 as she just kills time in the city and, you know, spends some time with her maid. She tries to rehearse some songs. She wanders out into the park. She hangs out with a friend a bit and watches a short film. And it's very much a film about Paris in that she's wandering through it and kind of encountering different people, including, you know, conversations with a taxi driver, with a soldier back from Algeria she meets. But it comes across not just as this kind of gorgeous, lively backdrop and a snapshot of Paris in the 60s, but also as this wonderfully indifferent backdrop, because this is a film about this kind of flighty, gorgeous, maybe somewhat shallow character who is forced to confront mortality. And she keeps running into all of these, you know, signs of death, no matter where she looks in the city, and starts to realize that maybe no one is taking her fear seriously, or that no one will miss her all that much. You know, she wants someone to act like they're as distressed as she is. But when will that, you know, when will that ever happen? No matter how good a friend is, it's your mortality that you have to grapple with. And so it's also a very interesting portrait of this character who maybe has never given a lot of thought to death or to what her life means.
Il y a trop de bruit ici avec leur musique. C'est fou. On ne s'entend plus parler.
Franchement, on ne peut pas vivre deux.
Ce sont des gens impossibles.
Ils sont spécialement comme ça avec vous ou avec tout le monde?
Avec tout le monde.
And who, over this very, very kind of normal day, other than the news she's waiting for, has to come to grips with it and to grips with her, like, you know, very charming but very kind of, you know, inessential life. And the fact that the city will keep going on without her if she were to die, that all these things would keep going on. There's a great scene where she's at a cafe and she puts her song on, and then she walks around the cafe to see if people mention it or if they react. And the only reaction she really hears is two people being like, "Ah, oh, I can barely talk to you over this noise." And it's one of many great scenes. It's a really nicely put together and kind of like very skillfully put together film in a very unshowy way, because it's all just conversations and following someone through the city. So it's Cleo from 5 to 7, and it is currently streaming on Hulu Plus, and it's a really great little film.
All right, I have to admit that's on my list of movies I've never seen. It's an oversight by me.
It's a good one. It goes down very easily, I think. And there might be something about it in description that sounds more like work than I think it actually is.
It's not romantic enough for me.
It's not romantic.
And I also hate the hours of between 5 and 7. That's least favorite time of day.
That's why you always skip them.
I do.
You go straight.
I sleep through them as a rule. So those are the two reasons. But given your recommendation, perhaps I will reconsider.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. My first pick, I would not say it's a classic, at least not a classic of Parisian cinema as we might traditionally think of it, but it is available on what I'm going to call the streaming trifecta. You can watch this on Amazon Prime, Hulu Plus, or Netflix right
Ooh.
Now. Whatever your pleasure, whatever your fancy, whatever your streaming preference, this movie is currently available on all three. It is Ronin, directed by John Frankenheimer. And I don't know why, but when I thought of Paris, this is one of the two movies I really thought of. Those great chase scenes.
That's it. You see a lot of it rush by.
You do see a lot of the city, you know, and I was thinking about that in terms of the amount of the city you see as it vrooms by these cars. You see a lot of it. The film, if it's famous at all, and I think it has a good reputation, it's from, I think, 1998. It's certainly not considered a masterpiece, but it's well regarded amongst car movie fans as a movie with great car chases. And I did take a look at the big Parisian car chase before we recorded this, and it is even better than I remembered. And you know, when you watch it, Paris is such a great setting for a car chase thing because the streets are so narrow
and busy
and you know, there's these wonderful shots. There's a lot of shots of sort of like from the perspective of the cars, and also sort of like right in front of the cars looking back at them, so you can see the cars on either, you know, the streets are like one lane with cars on either side parked. And you just feel the tension just of the cars zooming by on either side. And then they start driving on these tunnels and on these bigger highways. And, of course, there's cars coming the other direction. And it's just, you know, car chase. There's lots of great American car chase movies. A lot of them, though, take place on roads where it's a little bit wider. There's, you know, a lot of them take place on, like, deserts or highways where there's, like, lots of space, you know. This is like a car chase where it's claustrophobic, which is not necessarily two feelings you get together, claustrophobia and the excitement of a car chase. And this movie pulls that off really well. I have to say, though, looking at some of the rest of the movie this week also, it's a better written movie than I remembered. It has a lot of great dialogue. It definitely harkens back to some of those great French crime thrillers like Rififi that you mentioned. You know, there's a lot of great French, you know, new wave crime and noir films, and this one, although it's not in black and white, it's in color, it definitely has that vibe of the, you know, those really bleak and, you know, those tough guy French movies where they only say 5 words in every 20 minutes, but when they say them, they're really good. And I didn't realize, although he's credited as Richard Weiss, the script was revised, or depending on who you listen to, totally rewritten by David Mamet. And it has some of that. When you know that and you're listening to it, you know, somebody says to, like, De Niro, who's the star of the movie, like, "You worried about saving your own skin?" And he's like, "Yeah, I am. It covers my body."
Everybody has a limit. I spent some time in interrogation once.
They make it hard on you?
They don't make it easy. Yeah, it was unpleasant. I held out as long as I could. All the stuff they tried. You just can't hold out forever. Impossible.
How'd they finally get to you?
They gave me a grasshopper.
What's a grasshopper?
See, it's two-part gin, two-part brandy, one-part creme de menthe.
Fucking nonsense.
Very snappy dialogue. It is not from Cleo to 5 to 7. It is not, you know, it's not a great work of cinema. When we get right down to it, it is a crime movie. It's a car chase movie. But it's better than your standard. And, you know, as I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, it's like comparing this to modern Hollywood movies. And this movie isn't that old. It's, what, 15 years old.
Right.
But it is a movie of refinement, you know? It's like a great old wine compared to the Four Loko of modern Hollywood cinema. We don't want to get too pretentious about it here, Allison. We're all drinking to get drunk. But sometimes we want to get drunk classy. And that's what this movie is. You get drunk classy. That is Ronin. It is available now. Again, the streaming trifecta, Netflix, Amazon, or Hulu. Take your pick.
I have to say, I don't remember anything about the plot of that movie other than the car chases.
Right, and I didn't either, and I put it on, and it immediately starts with this great, like, just the atmosphere of this little French cafe, stormy night, the cobblestones, De Niro in his little hat, walking around, casing a joint, and then it gets into the plot, which is, you know, your standard, like, a bunch of people brought together for a crime.
Right.
But it's just the little details. It's precise, you know. I mean, you could make a whole thing that the whole thing is about precision, like precision driving.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. The little touches, the preciseness of it is what makes it good.
Yeah, and it's Natasha McElhone in the big driving.
That's
in the
right.
Scene, right? Which, that's definitely something I remember, because when you... like ever get to see
the woman in the car
woman.
Chase.
Yeah, in the car chase. Yeah. No, but I do agree. Paris is a great place for a car chase. I think with the first Bourne movie, right? Also.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I think so.
It was, yeah.
With the little car.
With the
Mini Coopers.
It's like a little, just like a little putt-putt car, basically.
Right, and going down the stairs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But I think that movie kind of travels a little too, so that's why I didn't want to include it. But I think
it was Paris. But either way,
we might be totally wrong.
Yeah, wrong.
People can correct us.
Yeah, but I do like the idea of the like tiny narrow streets as lending something.
It just instantly ratchets up the tension.
Right. All right. So my next film, I refer to it as a new classic. I was pretty much kidding, but I did.
And
enjoy
you
it.
With an umlaut classic?
Yes, okay. I did enjoy it very much, and it is District B-13, which is currently available for rent.
Now that is a romance.
On Amazon, iTunes, and Sony. This is a 2004 film directed by Pierre Morel and written and produced by Luc Besson. Morel, of course, one of Besson's kind of proteges, who's been cranking up films from the Besson factory.
Well,
he's probably, I would say, the best one.
I would, I'm trying to think if there's anyone better. I cannot think of one.
Yeah, I think he definitely bests Olivier Megaton.
He blows up Olivier Megaton, so to speak.
Yes.
And didn't he also direct a movie called From Paris with Love?
Maybe.
You should have picked that one.
I should have picked that one.
That's a Paris movie.
Yes. Well, what I liked about District B-13 is that it's a sci-fi film. You know, it's set in the dark future of 2013. I think it's 2013 because it starts off in 2010, and they explain that this suburb, this particular, you know, the suburbs are like getting more and more violent, and they've decided to wall this one off. And then in 3 years pass, and in those 3 years, that inside the walls, you know, it's become like chaos and crime
and parkour
and warlords and parkour taking over. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's a 2004 film, so they were not looking far into the future when they had this dystopic idea. And here we are, and it's all come true.
And it's all come true.
Yeah.
So everyone knows parkour.
I know. That's how I got to your house. It was basically by rolling down the side of the building. Anyway, you know, this is a film that involves parkour, and parkour I find as hilarious as it is impressive. Every time a character suddenly is like, allow me to, you know, bounce down the staircase outside of the building without using the stairs.
Well, it's mannered.
It's funny.
It's
very funny.
Yes.
But it looks very impressive. And there's no
Absolutely.
Other film, you know, even the parkour in this film is for real. It stars one of the co-founders of parkour, David Bell, as Leto, the character who is, you know, like the chief of maybe the only good building inside District B-13. Mm. But I do enjoy this. There's a kind of 70s style sci-fi here to the kind of big but silly idea. You know, it's got this kind of Escape from New York style idea to it. That
right.
You're like walling off the troubled suburbs, which is, you know, are a source of like a genuine like social conflict in France and in Paris, where the suburbs sounds misleading. Here, usually suburbs are wealthy, and they're there tend to be poor communities and public housing, and it's also where a lot of the immigrant communities live. So it kind of brushes over all kinds of actual real issues on its way towards extended parkour sequences in which people fight giant thugs named the Yeti. Also, corrupt government, neutron bomb, sister who's been chained up and made addicted to heroin, all kinds of
definitely
awesome,
a new classic
stuff.
And you yes. Umlaut classic. You
fais passer le message. J'aimerais bien la voir sa gueule quand il va apprendre la nouvelle.
La flamme est gueule, alors ça t'inspire? Qu'est-ce qu'on fait maintenant? Je te perce et on arrête l'histoire?
Tu me perces, il y a une bande de chiens enragés qui va se retrouver sans maître. Et ça, je pense pas que ça soit mieux. Mais qu'est-ce que tu veux?
Tu vois, t'as... c'est ça la différence entre nous deux. Toi, tu sais jamais ce qu'il y a dans ma tête. Alors que moi, je connais toute la merde qu'il y a dans la tienne. Je sais comment tu penses et ça me laisse toujours un coup d'avance.
It's a good time. It really is. Like, it's ridiculous and a lot of fun.
Okay.
So that is District B13. It is available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, and Sony.
And it's definitely a really accurate, authentic portrait of Paris.
I think so.
Yeah.
But for last time I was there.
Yeah. Now, what about, it's 2013 now. What about District 13 Ultimatum?
I have to say, I have not seen it. I know. You seen it?
Have I seen it?
Have you seen it multiple times?
Maybe.
And would you say
amazing?
Does it outdo?
I'm vaguely remembering a scene where they like drive a car into like it's almost like Carcore, like a car goes inside a building. I vaguely remember this. Honestly, there it kind of all blends together with the first one to be in my mind. But if you enjoy the first one, I think you'll enjoy the second one too.
Excellent. All right. Okay. So, what's your final pick?
Mine certainly not as classy a film as District 13. But one that I really like. And again, this is the one where it's possible on another week I might not have thought of this first, but given its director, it was it leapt to mind given our Listener's Choice review, and that's Holy Motors, which is the most recent film from Leos Carax, which, am I pronouncing it right? We were discussing this before we went on the air. You looked it up. What is the correct
pronunciation?
That was it. Leos Carax.
Yeah.
It's a made-up name, people. We can pronounce it
however we want.
However we want, yes. So, Holy Motors, you can rent it on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, and YouTube, or if you have a Netflix account, it is also available for streaming on Netflix. Bonus streaming pick this week as well. The film is about a man played by Denis Levant, who is the star of The Lovers on the Bridge as well. He spends his days playing all these different roles. One minute he might be a old homeless beggar woman, homeless, much like the star of Lovers on the Bridge, and the next minute he might be a motion capture performer in a high-tech movie studio, and we don't really understand exactly why he's doing this. He seems kind of like an actor, but there's no cameras around. It's not quite clear what's going on. You kind of just have to buy the ticket and take the ride here. This was also on my mind this week, Allison, because there was an article on the film website moviemezzanine.com, which I wrote a response to. The original article was about the connection between rewatchability and excellence, and the particular author of this piece was taking the stance that for a movie to be truly great, it needs to be rewatchable. He applied what he called the TNT test. Can a movie be played on TNT over and over and you will watch it? You, being one of the foremost experts on the movies of TNT.
Yes.
I thought
and
you,
TBS.
And TBS.
And all of the other channels that run movies throughout Saturdays.
That's right. I thought you might be able to weigh in on this. But part of it was he sort of cited Holy Motors as a movie you can't rewatch over and over, which I just completely disagreed with. I mean, I disagreed with his main point as well, and we don't want to get too sidetracked, but it was just, I mean, it just shows you how subjective this all is anyway. But I find Holy Motors, which was my favorite movie of last year, just so rewatchable, and I just, you know, not even in whole or in part, because it's so episodic.
It exists in parts really well.
Yeah, you can kind of just turn on any different section, because it really is all these disconnected little vignettes of Denis Levant's character putting on all these roles. And the one that I rewatched for the podcast, because it was the one I thought of because of The Lovers on the Bridge, is the scene with Kylie Minogue where they're walking through the abandoned department store and she's singing that beautiful song. And at the end of it, they go up onto the roof and they're overlooking the city and overlooking the bridge from The Lovers on the Bridge. And I think you're supposed to think of it for sure, because Carax is not only making a movie about all of film, but he's also making a movie about his films. There's a lot of returning to his ideas and characters and themes and what have you. So It's hard not to think of The Lovers on the Bridge when you're watching that scene.
Who were we? Who were we? When we were who we were back then. Who would we have become if we'd done differently?
And I did love this movie last year. I still love it. I think it's really beautiful. It's hard to describe without making it sound pretentious. You kind of just have to take my word for it that it's...
It's also, I mean, the thing is, it's also beautiful at parts and incredibly silly at parts.
Silly.
Yeah.
Serious.
Funny.
Funny.
Yeah.
Disturbing. Yeah. It's really, it's all movies in a lot of ways. And it's by design. And it's a movie about movies because he's maybe playing this actor, putting on these roles. But as I was thinking about it in this context, it's also, you could say, a movie about Paris. It's a movie about the city. And you really get a sense in a city symphony type way of all these different parts of the city. The underworld, the fashionistas, just average people going about their lives, people who are dying. You know, it's just, you really get a flavor of the scope of the city, the scope of life in the city in a way you don't get in a lot of other movies that are a little more focused. And again, that's something that in this case, I think, is to its credit. So, Holy Motors, available again on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, YouTube, or for streaming on Netflix. If you haven't seen it yet, go for it. Just be prepared for a little weirdness. Don't expect it to all make sense. Let you decide how it makes sense. It's that sort of movie where the meaning is not thrust upon you. You can thrust your own meaning upon it.
Get that one.
Now it's time for our listener's choice section, in which we offer up three choices for you to pick from for our main review. Your options this round were all films that weren't new to streaming, but that we'd saved and been meaning to watch for a while. Ben Wheatley's first film, Down Terrace, Leos Carax's The Lovers on the Bridge, and Andrei Tarkovsky's final film, The Sacrifice. And the winner by very few votes was The Lovers on the Bridge, though The Sacrifice, which came in third, did get like a solid 25% of the vote.
This is one of our closer ones.
This was a close one.
This was a tight race.
So, The Lovers on the Bridge is currently streaming on Netflix, though I should point out that the version on the site is not the ideal one. It's a pan and scan version, so...
Not HD. We often, like, credit Netflix, oh, this movie looks so good on streaming. Not this time.
Yeah, this is not. So, if you may want to look to other places to see this film. And also, if you're a Netflix subscriber, might be worth sending them a note about this. They seem to just go with the version that's given to them by the rights holder, but the more it's made clear that, you know, things like this are important to their customers, the more likely they'll pay attention to things like aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. I mean, Old Boy, the version that was originally on Netflix, was dubbed.
Right.
And enough people wrote about it and complained about it that it's
they
now...
They changed it.
Yeah, it's switched out.
All right. So, well, start kvetching, listeners.
Yes, they do listen.
Yeah.
So The Lovers on the Bridge is the third feature film from Leos Carax, and it would have fit well with our topic from the last episode, which was films that sat on the shelf.
Oh, that's true.
This is a film that was released in France in 1991, but didn't hit U.S. theaters until 1999, thanks to Miramax, who picked it up and then sat on it. Miramax, who are often the source of these stories, or later the Weinstein Company.
I was going to say, Weinstein Company. Yes.
The film had a troubled production that led to its being infamously expensive. I think it was the most expensive French film ever at the time, which is very funny when you look, it's not like a special effects, you know, extravaganza of aliens and things like that. It's a love story, but it's due in part to...
It's a Parisian romance.
Due in part to its requiring a full model of the Pont Neuf, which is the bridge on which it's set, as no one would agree to shut down the actual bridge, highly trafficked bridge in the center of the city for 3 months. So the film stars Juliette Binoche and Denis Levant, who starred in all but one of Carax's films, as Michelle and Alex, who are two vagrants living on the Pont Neuf, the oldest bridge in Paris, which has been shut down for repairs. Michelle is a painter whose eyesight is failing and who's had her heart broken, while Alex is a street performer who's addicted to drugs and alcohol. And the two have an ecstatic, if troubled, romance set against the backdrop of the country's 1989 bicentennial celebrations, including a famous scene in which Alex steals a police boat so that Michelle can water ski past the fireworks on the Seine. But Michelle is slowly going blind, and Alex is fiercely possessive, such that he does things to keep Michelle by his side that essentially involve hurting her in indirect ways, or sometimes direct. So, Matt, this is a romance about two homeless people, mm-hmm. and while I don't think it's a central question to the film, it's one I'd like to delve into first, since it's both an ecstatic fairy tale and gritty. What did you think of its portrayal of homelessness by way of Alex, Michelle, and their friend Hans?
That's a good question, actually, because it was something I did think about when I was watching it, which is that so many films... I'm giving away the game here, because I thought about maybe writing this as a piece. So nobody steal this if I share this idea. Homeless people are almost, in movies, almost a category unto themselves, like... You know, like a Manic Pixie Dream Girls.
Yes,
like a lot of times,
they're magical.
Homeless people are sort of there to suffer and martyr themselves for the betterment of non-homeless people. And they somehow improve their lives. I think we can all think of movies like that. The one that immediately came to mind for me was Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, where like the woman in New York like helps Macaulay Culkin, the Turtle Doves, that whole thing, and like doesn't exist as a person, but just as a like magical figure to help Macaulay Culkin on his journey. You know, that's what really matters, is not this person who's homeless and destitute. It's the kid who's living in the plaza but missing his family. Like, that's what it's all about. So I thought that in a lot of movies that happens, and that perhaps that is something to explore and maybe hasn't been explored fully enough. And in this movie, I don't know, at first I was like, oh wow, this is really gritty and a side of homelessness we don't often see in movies. But then at other times it does get a little magical as well. And that scene that you pointed to with the fireworks, the bicentennial, it does at times become almost this beautiful vision of homelessness and vagrancy and outsiderdom, and has a sort of romantic view of it. And on the other hand, sometimes it has a really bleak view of it. So I don't know. It's funny, because what I admired initially was that it was sort of, in my mind, a rebuke to that stereotype of the magical homeless person. And yet sometimes the scenes I liked best were the ones that were a little more surreal and a little more outrageous. And that sometimes as it went on, I found the grittiness didn't really jive all that well with the surreal nature of it. What did you think?
Yeah, it was one of those things. I haven't seen this film for a long time and I didn't remember much about it. So going back into it, I was concerned about the idea of homelessness being made cute.
Right.
Right. But I don't think it is. I do think, you know,
no.
When it is like the kind of, and it is, you know, not in a love story way, but like it is an incredibly romantic film in mm-hmm. this kind of sweeping idea of the city as the empty city, particularly as a playground, right? The city at night when everyone's sleeping, it has this amazingly beautiful vision of it. And I think that that part is really interesting. It's almost like the characters have kind of, like, homelessness is for these three characters, and it gives up on kind of a larger view very quickly. You know, it's only in the beginning that we see the characters getting picked up in the kind of by the cops in their nightly sweep where they bring everyone to a shelter. And that's pretty grim. It's almost more like that for this trio on the bridge, like you're kind of almost backstage in life. You know, you're not in the same level of existence that everyone else is anymore. And I think you have these scenes where Alex is like brushing his teeth while everyone's going by on the sidewalk, or when he steals a fish, where it's almost like they are invisible, you know, for a bit.
Right.
Especially him, who's so clearly homeless looking. Michelle can kind of go back and forth between being, you know, one of them, and then she puts on sunglasses and goes to the cafe to kind of, and she blends in, right? But I think positioning it that way was very interesting and worked with the idea that, like, the city at night becomes this glorious, you know, free place.
Yeah.
But it didn't bother me. Like, I didn't have that sense of it, of overplaying that hand, of kind of overly romanticizing, because the life that they have is very difficult, and it is killing her, basically.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
It's not good for her.
No.
at all.
And that was one of the things that I thought was very interesting about the movie, was the depiction of this quote-unquote romance. You know, the title, which is an, you know, it's not an exact title of the original French title. The Lovers on the Bridge suggests some sort of beautiful romance. And actually, this movie is pretty disturbing, frankly. The lengths that Denis Levant's character will go to stay with the Juliette Binoche character, like you said, I mean, he's willing to hurt her, literally or metaphorically. I mean, there are some of the best scenes, actually, are the ones where he goes to these disturbing lengths to ensure that she won't leave him.
Yeah.
All of my favorite scenes in the movie were those, other than that one really incredible bicentennial sequence, which sort of exists almost outside
the reality
of the movie, which, and it's just so extravagant and beautiful. Yeah, that you just can't help but be swept away by the pure ecstatic joy of it.
Yeah, but you know, all of the mentions of romance in the film are, it's this incredible burden, like almost this painful thing, right? The romance that Binoche's character had that kind of set her partially on this path, along with her eyesight going, is with this cellist named Julian. And it, like, destroyed her, right? Like, it kind of drove her from home.
Mm-hmm.
And she has this dream in which she goes and tries to kill him, right? And then when Hans recounts what happened to his marriage, it's another story in which he kind of, like, couldn't help but follow the woman he loved, you know, down this path of destruction.
Right.
And it's like, there's no choice. Of course I did it.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Like this, it's like the madness and or selfishness and or destructiveness of love.
Yeah, that it's this... It's this fever, right? Mm-hmm. Almost that you're in the grip of it, and that it's not necessarily a happy thing. It can be delirious.
There's moments of ecstasy, followed by incredible pain and agony sometimes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I did think it made it a much more interesting story, I think, than a typical romance.
Mm.
That kind of the disturbing undertones and the sense that you're not really sure that you want a happily ever them to run off into the sunset together, because it doesn't seem like a very healthy relationship.
I was pretty sure I did not want them to run off and have a happy ending in the sunset. You weren't sure? You thought maybe that would be a good see to
well,
me like
I feel like they both I mean he
they're
has
so
very,
screwed up they
well,
deserve
has,
each other
no but I mean he has very obvious signs of kind of like of his very obvious signs of problems.
Yes,
but I feel like she also does, right?
Okay.
She has kind of quieter imbalances that
yes.
lead her to do things that are also unwise.
True.
So I don't
She's
know.
She's less overtly destructive.
Right.
And possessive.
But is also so in the grips of kind of these emotions that she basically also set her life aflame.
Yeah.
Right?
True. I have to say, like, one of the things that I was maybe, I don't know, disliked, uncomfortable with, whatever, was the end of this movie. I didn't quite know how to feel about it, actually. I think it
felt pretty bittersweet to me. I definitely was not.
That's yeah.
Yeah.
Without spoiling it, that is that's a very generous way of putting it, actually. I don't know.
Did you like this movie?
I did like it overall. I definitely don't like it as much as Holy Motors. And I feel like in some ways the movie kind of highlights what I love about Holy Motors and what I love about his filmmaking, which is those like ecstatic moments. Like he's much more like, I don't know, he works best in that surreal mode where he can have these flights of fancy. And the moments in Lovers on the Bridge that work best are those really surreal or very visual, or the moments that kind of stand apart from the narrative. And I don't feel like the story here is really the strength of it. I almost feel like, you know, it would be best as like a segment, or taking the different segments out and watching them separately. I feel like that's his strength. And that's why I love Holy Motors. And in this case, some of those ecstatic moments, like I said, they don't always seem to fit comfortably with some of the darker sections of the movie.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole movie is about this really delirious moment that's like by nature temporary in their lives, right?
Mm.
Like, it's based around the bridge as a place to live, which it's going to be fixed someday, right? And people are going to be walking across it.
Right.
And you can't live on it anymore.
Sure.
Right? There's like even the bubble that they live on, mm-hmm. like they live in, is temporary. Even like the summer in which it's possible to live outside,
right,
is really
right.
temporary. And I feel like that lends itself to the ecstatic nature of the relationship, particularly in the case of Binoche's character, where she's kind of like, she's kind of waiting it out, right? She's like kind of ready to die in some ways. And that like allows her to have this kind of crazy freedom that comes through in those scenes of like when they go to the beach or when they go anywhere else. It's really when she starts making plans for the future that he freaks out.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that the ending, as much as it is very uneasy, it is that idea that they are going to maybe try to have without that, see what happens, right? Without the kind of like incredible bubble. And I don't know that it was.
It's kind of horrifying.
I know.
They might, to me.
Yeah, but if you can hope that one of them, right, can put together a normal life.
Yeah.
Then like you have to allow that the other might as well. And who knows where it could go?
Maybe.
Yeah. I'm not saying I don't think that it'll work out well, frankly.
No.
But I think, you know.
I just love the movie. I mean, I did like the movie, and to me, like any movie that has some sequences that are as good as some of the sequences in this movie, like the Bicentennial, like the sequence where he goes into the subway and he sees these posters, like, you know, like missing posters for her, and destroys them to try to keep her again, because he's so possessive and people are looking for her. There are these, like, you know, missing posters. And it's not just that, it's that he peels the poster off. So, you know, like on a literal level, it's like an amazing scene. But then like the idea of trying to destroy her image, trying to tear her down. And then the fact that like as he's doing it, one eye, like if you watch, one eye is like the only thing that's left. Like he pulls her face off, but one eye, they must have done it like with pastes particularly, like one eye stays up and it relates to her vision being failing her, and it's the one eye that's already blind. It's like, it's that scene like blew my mind.
Well,
and then he's
burning
down
them. Yeah. I mean, like that, I feel like
which
those,
connects
that
to
image,
his
yeah,
fire breathing and his destructiveness.
Yeah.
I mean,
there are so many scenes like that. Like the fire breathing is an amazing scene. The scene where they go to the museum is an amazing scene. Even the scene where they watch, they kind of, there's a low window at a nightclub and they watch everyone's feet, you know?
Another great scene.
There are some incredible, incredible scenes in this.
Yeah.
And I think I liked it a lot more than I, like I said, I saw this years ago and I don't remember feeling strongly about it. And I liked it much, much more in rewatching it.
The one other thing I would mention before we wrap it up is, you know, I didn't go into this with a ton of context. I certainly knew who the director was. I knew who the stars were. But I didn't know about that it was, you know, such a hugely troubled production. I knew it was delayed, but I didn't really know the extent of it. And I didn't know about that they had to recreate the bridge in the middle of a lake somewhere, and that they built all the buildings around. It's like one article I read, I think, compared it to almost like the Apocalypse Now of French cinema, which
is the Heaven's Gate
of French cinema.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just funny because it's weird how time kind of can, depending on the movie, it can kind of erase a movie's reputation. Like, I think a lot of people who probably saw this movie when it first came out came to it with a lot of baggage. You know, that this is a huge movie, that it must be important, that it has to be big, that it's because it's, you know, it costs so much money, and they willingly or unwillingly kind of put that baggage on it. And I didn't know any of that until after I saw it. And it's funny because I would have had, I mean, certainly I could feel that there was a certain amount of messiness to it. And I would have felt definitely that there's the ambition and that it's trying to reach for some grandeur on a metaphorical or a thematic level. But I definitely wouldn't have guessed that this was the most expensive movie of all time at the time it was made or whatever. Like, I just, that would have never occurred to me. Or that it took 3 years to make and it sat on the shelf for 7 years. So it's just interesting to come to a movie later after that has faded and then to realize that, oh, you know, that this movie has this huge reputation and this infamy that I have no idea about. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, remember also that people in the US, when they finally saw it, were also getting it much later than it was probably the initial, like the French audiences who were dealing with the major story and it coming off of, you know, and cracks coming off of two movies, one very small and one slightly bigger. But yeah, it's a lot of baggage to deal with as a filmmaker.
But even again, if you saw it in like 99 or whatever, the fact that it had sat on the shelf for seven years.
I think that's it. Then it became like a cult film, right? At that point. Oh, this film, like this from this, you know, great promising filmmaker.
Right.
Have you heard? Yeah. Well, so that is The Lovers on the Bridge. It is currently streaming on Netflix. Though, you know, as we said, buyer beware. Okay, it's time for Behind the Eight Ball, the section in which we run through three films that are new to streaming, two that are listener recommendations, and one from our Netflix My List.
Are you waiting for me to say something?
I can't imagine what.
My list.
Thank you. Matt, you're going to go first. Are you ready? You're like smiling so much from having gotten to do that. You got it together? You got it? You got it?
I'm ready.
All right.
Yes.
Three new films.
I need to be serious because actually my first pick is not a funny movie at all, but it is a good one. It is now available on Netflix. It's The Central Park Five, documentary directed by Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, and David McMahon. And it is based, or it's about, the notorious case of the Central Park jogger from 1989 who was attacked by, well, at the time they thought it was this group of teenagers, but it turned out that they were falsely accused, falsely convicted. And the film is about the case, the trial, and also about what happened after the fact and how this case represented the sort of the broken soul of the city at the time and the broken justice system to a certain extent. An interesting documentary, to say the least. Definitely worth checking out. It's The Central Park Five. It's available now on Netflix. Next up, a little bit lighter film. This is going to be available on VOD starting on October 8th. It's a film I saw and really liked at South by Southwest this year called Zero Charisma, directed by Katie Graham and Andrew Matthews. It is about a grumpy, surly Dungeons & Dragons enthusiast named Scott Wiedemeyer, played in a very good performance by a guy named Sam Eidson. He finds his Dungeons and Dragons under assault, Allison, from the worst thing imaginable, a cool hipster geek. This is a very affectionate portrait of really hardcore geekdom, hardcore nerdery, but it's not a fawning one either. It's pretty clear-eyed. I mean, this guy, Scott Wiedemeyer, although we do come to really like him a lot, he's not a great guy. He is kind of mean, snotty, obnoxious, super nerdy. But, you know, it kind of investigates this idea of not quite fake geek girls. I'm sure you've heard that term, Allison.
Oh, yeah.
Because the fake geek in question here, if you want to call him that, is a guy. But it does kind of investigate these ideas of nerdiness and geekiness. And can you be a nerd and be kind of cool? Can you be a nerd and dress well and have a good job and a cool girlfriend? And if those people are geeks, what does that mean for the guys who still kind of fit into the old stereotype? That's Zero Charisma. It's available on VOD starting on October 8th. And finally, a movie I don't love, but I have to admit, I'm going to say something I never thought I would say. I'm actually thinking about rewatching it. From 2006, The Fountain. It's available now on Amazon Prime.
I love it.
I know you love this movie. I did not love it when it came out. But it's interesting because I remember when it came out, we were the early days of our podcasting careers.
Yes.
Back then. I think we might have reviewed it on the old IFC show. It's possible. We certainly talked about it a lot. And
we
it
did,
was a
yes.
very divisive movie. It's this super, you know, hoity-toity, pretentious, artsy-fartsy Darren Aronofsky
but
reaching.
Big-hearted,
very
like
sincere,
yeah.
Huge-hearted. You know, he is reaching for the stars. He is going full out. I believe kamikaze auteurism was the term
yes.
used to describe it at the time by Jay Hoberman. You know, Hugh Jackman playing three different roles. Tomas, the conquistador, looking for the, you know, like the old tree of life. Tom, the neurosurgeon, trying to cure his wife of, like, inoperable cancer. And then, what is it? Tommy, the space Buddhist dude who's bald, who's in a bubble in space. Going to, like, this literal tree in the... I don't know. I always thought it was a bit full of itself and a bit, maybe, a little high on its ideals. But I have to admit, as its reputation has grown, and it really has become this cult movie and kind of the symbol of everything that's sort of wrong with Hollywood now. Like, this movie would never be made now, just 7 years later.
No one was happy they made it then.
That's true. It was a kind of like, how did this get made
then?
Yeah,
I mean, like, I don't think it's good to hold up as like, here's what the studio system used to do.
Right.
Because they would look at it as
right,
a mistake.
Right, exactly. It wasn't so much made as it escaped, sort of. But I don't know. There is something about it that I am interested in going back and revisiting. And I can now because it's available for streaming on Amazon.
Oh, I'm very curious to hear what you think of that.
Yeah, we'll see if I actually go back and look at it again.
Yeah.
It is romantic, and I'm all about romance.
It is. And it's about death, too.
Absolutely.
So it's a good pairing. Mm. All right, two listener recommendations.
All right, I'm going to start with this one from Christopher, who says, I would like to recommend Whit Stillman's The Last Days of Disco. I wish I could write something that is as clever and witty as the movie is, but I cannot. So instead, I'll just say it's a wonderful film, and if you are a fan of well-written dialogue performed by perfectly cast actors, then you will like The Last Days of Disco. That is available now on Netflix, and I've also got a recommendation here from Martin, who says, I would like to recommend to you the 2013 zombie movie The Battery. It was made for only $6,000, but these guys made an amazing movie. Rather than being your average zombie flick, it's far more of a character piece about two guys backpacking through rural Connecticut. You see the relationship between the two of them and how it develops, and how one character can't let go of civilization that no longer exists, while the other is excited about it, enjoying a survivalist lifestyle. The backwoods and fields of Connecticut look stunning. It's a magnificently shot film, and I think you guys should talk about it on your podcast. It's available to rent through just about every pay service you can think of, plus you can buy a digital copy of the movie outright, DRM-free, from their website, thebatterymovie.com. I can assure you I am not one of the makers of the film. I am just a film enthusiast who is totally in love with this movie and would love to hear your takes on it. We haven't seen it yet, but it sounds intriguing, and there you go. Martin recommends The Battery.
All right, and one from your My List.
My List. You gave me number 37. Which, this episode is Jailbreakers. I think you're going to like this one, Allison. It's a 1994 TV movie directed by William Friedkin.
Ooh.
And starring Shannon Doherty. Wait. And Antonio Sabato Jr. Yes. This originally aired as part of this fascinating Showtime series called Rebel Highway, which was actually remakes, or very loose remakes, where they would just take the title and make a new movie, of old 50s B movies by some really interesting directors. Our friend and colleague R. Emmett Sweeney discovered this series, don't ask me how, but he found it, and he found that a lot of the episodes were available on Netflix, including Jailbreakers. So I added all of them. I haven't watched any of them because I'm a horrible person, but this one and a bunch of the others are sitting on my list. So this one is Jailbreakers, but if you're interested in the series, if that idea of like cool filmmakers remaking old 50s B movies sounds interesting, now the series was called Rebel Highway, and you can find like all information about it if you just like Wikipedia it or IMDb it, and then if you look for individual episodes, they all have different names, but if you look for the individual episodes on Netflix, you'll find a bunch of them. So there you go, Jailbreakers and Rebel Highway, available on Netflix. Are you ready, Allison, for your countdown?
I am ready.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, my first new release is a film that I haven't seen yet and was really surprised to see turn up on Netflix, and that is Salinger, which is Shane Salerno's documentary about J.D. Salinger, the famous and reclusive author. This film only got a theatrical release on September 6th, so it's very surprising to see it already on Netflix, though I think that was part of a deal that the Weinstein Company made, so there you go. You didn't have to buy a ticket for it after all, I guess, is the lesson to be learned? Question mark?
I've seen it.
Yes.
I'm going to, just the first time I've ever done this, I think, on 40-something episodes of the show.
Yes.
I'm going to say, do not listen to Allison. Flat out. Don't do it. I don't care if it's free. I don't care if it's streaming on Netflix. This is a horrible movie. Unless the only reason you should watch it is,
yes,
if you want to see how not to make a documentary.
Yes.
It is, in some ways, the ultimate example of the Alison Wilmore test of documentaries,
yes,
in that it is a fascinating story, J.D. Salinger. It is a terrible movie. It is almost like how not to make a movie about an interesting study. It's horrible.
Wow. Interesting. Well, so Salerno, who may be best known for writing
Armageddon
at age 24.
Yes.
Worked on it for 5 years and
spent his own money.
Yes.
Yes. He put his own like $2 million into the film. I have nothing against the guy.
Right, but
admirable to be passionate about a project, to make his own movie. But I have to tell you, I saw this movie and it is horrible.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting about it to me is that the Weinstein Company attempted to make happen this like keep the secrets,
right,
marketing campaign,
right,
that suggested there were some incredible twists hiding in the movie,
right,
that critics would be like sworn to secrecy on if they saw it. And yet most of the details have emerged. And
right.
None
well,
of them
almost
are
immediately
that,
the Times in an article,
yes,
kind of spoiled
it.
Not in a review. They just kind of revealed this
news.
Yeah, this news, this
there.
Revelation at,
yeah,
the end of the movie. And frankly, the reason I suspect is because there's really very little else about the movie that's appealing. That's right. A reason to see it.
And I mean, I feel like if you're going to go with that kind of approach, it, the reveal needs to be that, like, J.D. Salinger is, has been, you know, I don't know, 18 people all along. There was never a J.D. Salinger.
No, or, it's nothing, you know, that shocking.
J.D. Salinger is an alien. J.D. No. Salinger, you know, is alive and is actually just Shane Salerno. You
right.
Know?
Now, that would be interesting. No, yes. It's a lot of the, like, revelations are like, here is never before seen footage of J.D. Salinger in World War II. And yes. It's like, literally, it's 45 seconds of the back of J.D. Salinger as he accepts a bunch of flowers from a bunch of, like, European awesome. Peasants.
Yes. You know, the cult of J.D. Salinger has never been something I've really understood. I mean, like, you know, Catcher in the Rye is something I read in high school.
Sure, we all
enjoyed,
did.
Like, all of us.
Absolutely.
But I think the kind of response to this has been great to track in terms of how people feel about the divulging of his secrets. And some people are like, this is great and fascinating, and some people are like, this is outrageous and you can't do that to this guy who's dead.
To me, it's neither. Like, yes. It's a little unsettling, it's a little queasy at times,
yes.
But like, that doesn't bother me if the things he was discovering were really, really interesting. Allison, this is a movie where there's a title card on screen to explain what The Catcher in the Rye is about. If you don't know what The Catcher in the Rye is about, why are you watching this movie?
I don't know.
No.
Yes. Anyway, so with Matt's warning in place,
yes,
Salinger is now available.
Watch
for
at your
streaming
own peril, people.
On Netflix. And then my other two recommendations. The next one is also a documentary. It is called Me at the Zoo, and it is streaming on Hulu. And this is a 2012 doc that attempts to chronicle a phenomenon that didn't exist a decade ago, which would be internet celebrity. Directed by Chris Mukerbal and Valerie Veach. It focuses on Chris Crocker, who became infamous for...
Oh, is he the Leave Britney Alone
Leave
guy?
Leave Britney Alone,
wow.
Yes. And it looks into,
that.
You know, he was a kid living in Tennessee, in a small town in Tennessee. And it kind of follows how you can become famous online for something, you know, as seemingly as throwaway as this video. And also kind of what the upsides and downsides of it are, you know, and kind of how someone can, like, how useful maybe this fame can be to someone who's seeking celebrity. So it's an interesting documentary. It's Me at the Zoo on Hulu.
Right, that one sounds interesting.
Yes.
You've redeemed yourself.
Thank
in my
you.
Eyes.
And finally, one more pick from Hulu. It is called a film called Intacto. This is a 20, sorry, And one last pick, it's also on Hulu. It's a film called Intacto, 2001, the feature debut from director Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, who did 28 Weeks Later, the surprisingly good sequel to 28 Days Later. And this film is, it's about an underground ring, basically based on luck, on the idea that certain people are just, like, luck is this quantity you can have, like a talent. And that some people can take your luck by touching you. And there are different games played to test who is the luckiest. And these involve everything from Russian roulette to this great sequence in which all of the contestants are blindfolded and they have to run through the forest. You know, and so if you're lucky, you're not going to run smack into a tree.
Right. Oh, that's
yes.
Cool.
And so it's a film that maybe has more to it in terms of concept than it has in story. It doesn't really stick the landing, but it's a little
escape from tomorrow-ish in that way, perhaps.
It's really, really interesting in concept. And it does have a great performance from Max von Sydow in it as the luckiest man who, you know.
And playing himself, I think, is what you mean.
Right. You know, but like the very ideas of like what proves someone lucky, like someone who is like the lone survivor of a plane crash or all of that. So it's a really interesting film. And Fresnadillo, you know, is a definitely a talented filmmaker. 28 Weeks Later, I think, is kind of has attest to that. So this is the film that got him the Hollywood attention. It's called Intacto on Hulu.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, I have two listener recommendations, both from guys named John.
Different guys named John?
Different guys named John.
The first, we're huge with Johns.
Yes, the first is from John from Ohio.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
He recommends Daisies. He writes, this last week, sort of on a whim, I watched the Czech film Daisies on Hulu Plus. It's a bit hard to summarize the plot. Two girls want to be spoiled and do whatever they want, so they do. There are some great odd camera techniques used throughout this movie, and it might be weird, but I had a lot of fun with it. So that is Daisies. On
He's
Hulu
pushing
Plus.
Daisies, this guy.
He is. Yeah. Make another joke about Johns. okay. And the other John says, A movie I found completely by accident and absolutely adored, it was number two on my top 10 list of 2012, was Unicorn City, a low-budget indie about a loser who dreams of getting a job at Warlocks of the Beach and ends up creating a gamer utopia in the woods. It's a sweet and funny love story that just about any geek could appreciate. And it is currently streaming on Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, HitBliss, and Redbox. So there's another indie for you, geek culture indie for
you. There you go. Can make a nice little double feature. Okay, and one random film from your my list.
You gave me number 11, which is Broken English. That's the 2007 Zoe Cassavetes film starring Parker Posey as a New York woman who has trouble finding love, and then she meets a dreamy Frenchman played by Melville Poupeau, and then chases him, I think, to Paris. But I haven't.
You haven't seen this one?
I haven't seen it. Okay. Yes. Hence its place on my list. Okay. But yeah, if it's one I've heard good things about, and someday, perhaps, I will see it.
All right. Well, it's time to get to our listeners' choice options for our next episode. And that's going to be coming out like the week before Halloween. So it seems only fitting to do a Halloween-themed episode. So we've got three options here for you for instant screaming. Hold on, I'm just letting everyone recover from the incredible terror that I instilled in them. They're probably all in the fetal position on the ground, and they're probably recovering now, maybe wiping the sweat. Okay, I think we're good. Allison,
yes.
I think you have our first option for instant screaming. What is it?
First up is Carrie, which is currently streaming on Netflix, as are the other two films that we're going to offer you, all on Netflix this time. It is a 1976 film from Brian De Palma, based on the Stephen King novel, about a young girl who comes into her own and goes to the prom with her dream boy.
Ah!
Yes. Also, Pig's Blood, etc. Soon to be remade with Chloe Moretz and Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's scary.
That is scary. Yes. But now we are looking at
the original
right. Starring Sissy Spacek in really fantastic performance.
That's right.
And it'll be good to take another look at this, especially with the remake coming out.
Yeah, what better way to prepare for a dicey looking new remake than by revisiting the original classic?
Exactly.
Nothing like blowing the new movie out of the water before it even has a chance.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, that's option one. Option number two is the original version of a horror movie that was recently remade. Actually, the remake isn't terrible. It's a fun movie. It's from 1978. It's directed by a man I enjoy named Joe Dante, and the film is Piranha, the low-budget Jaws knockoff. I'm not sure how scary this one actually is. I think I've seen it once or twice, maybe, but something I wouldn't mind revisiting and checking out. The Joe Dante cult, I think, is something that's kind of been growing in recent years. You know, the guy made a lot of great movies, but maybe didn't have a great, you know, auteurist reputation. But I think that's something that's been growing recently as people keep going back to look at movies like Gremlins, like Matinee, like a lot of movies. He made some great stuff. But this was one of his very first films while he was kind of coming up through the ranks of the Roger Corman school, and was tasked with making a blatant Jaws knockoff, which he did, but did very successfully. So that is a Piranha. It is streaming on Netflix for instant screaming. Allison, what's our third film available on instant screaming?
Our third film is Pulse. It's a 2001 horror film from Kiyoshi Kurosawa.
I'm really scared. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I'll try to control myself.
This is a really scary film, actually.
This one, I have to admit, I've never seen. Yeah. I've heard it's absolutely terrifying.
It's really frightening. Remade in 2006. Yes, I'd steer clear of that one, the American remake. This one is about ghosts invading the land of the living via the internet, which manages to be much more frightening than that sounds. I think, in particular, this was one of the defining kind of big films of the J-horror
right.
wave that kind of came in and then made all ghosts and all movies look like women with hair in their face. Yes, but the ghosts in this one are particularly frightening because they're so other.
Okay.
They're not even necessarily like the kind of ghosts who seem intent on frightening you as much as just they're so alien. And there is something that's like just very troubling about that. So it's a scary film, and you know, I watched it the first time with my hands over my eyes, so maybe this time I'll take one hand off and watch just with one hand over both eyes.
It's interesting that we didn't even intend it as we were picking them out, but not only are they all horror movies, they're all horror movies that have remakes.
Yeah, interesting
how that worked out. Well, which original movie that was later turned into a remake should we review on the next spine-chilling episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter into the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, October 14th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our terrifying conversation on our next episode, which will be on or around Tuesday, October 22nd.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discussed on the episode. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 terrifying weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.